Good morning. I'm opening today's House Revenue Committee. We have some technical things to do, and so I am first going to open a work session on bill introduction. Mr. Barnhart.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which LC 2584 was introduced as a committee bill.
Rep. Barnhart moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which LC 2584 was introduced as a committee bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move the vote by which LC 2584 was introduced as a committee bill be reconsidered.
Rep. Barnhart moves the vote by which LC 2584 was introduced as a committee bill be reconsidered. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered, and the vote is reconsidered.
Madam Chair, I move LC 2584 dated 1-10-11 be substituted for LC 2584 dated 12-2-10 and it be introduced as a committee bill.
Rep. Barnhart moves LC 2584 dated 1-10-11 be substituted for LC 2584 dated 12-2-10 and be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Rep. Reed?
Madam Chair, dare I ask the reason for the substitution?
Yes.
No, you don't dare ask. The wrong copy was introduced, and LC caught it before it was, printed or first read. So we are substituted for the correct draft.
Thank you. What happens when you do things by email and electronically is that sometimes an earlier version gets brought to the committee. Fortunately, LC caught the problem, and we have the correct version now.
And we can do it now rather than it just gets more complicated later.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking. I have never seen a script like this, Representative. Okay, is there any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none? So ordered, and LC 2584, dated 1-10-11, will be introduced as a committee bill.
Now we have these others.
Madam
Chair, I move that LC 1804, LC 1947, LC 2126, LC 2584, LC 2984 be introduced as committee bills.
You already did 2584.
2584, we've already... Well, leave that out of my motion.
Okay. Rep. Barnhart moves LC 1804, LC 1947, LC 2126, and LC 2984 be introduced as committee bills. Any objection? Remembering that committee bills do not... The introduction of committee bills does not imply support or objection to any of the concepts in these bills by any member of this committee. Thank you. Ordered, they are submitted as committee bills.
Okay. You all get to sign.
And we both get to sign. Okay.
Wonderful.
Close the work session on bill introductions. And committee members, we have before us the property tax deferral program. Some of us have had some vetting on the problems that are before us on this program. We're going to have an informational meeting to begin with to talk about how we got here. And there has been a work group I have been a part on to talk about possible solutions. We will later introduce a bill that is basically a skeleton for possible fixes, but the fixes are going to have to come through the processes here. The bill doesn't fix things; it just is a vehicle for fixing things. So I'm going to ask John Phillips to come forward and bring with him whoever he cares to talk about the issues that are before us and some of the policy decisions that have to be made in order to keep this a solvent program. Thank you, John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips, the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you for taking up this item early in session. It's a very, we believe it's a very urgent issue to deal with. We first brought this concern to you early in last session, 2009. And I just want to give you a little background on the deferral program. In the property tax, this is the only program for seniors for benefits in terms of a specific exemption type or some kind of help for seniors who are in their homes. The program in Oregon was the first in the nation, started back in the 60s, and it really became a program like it is today in the 1980s. Essentially, what it does is that it, rather than deferring property taxes for seniors, the state actually pays the property tax of seniors, and then the repayment is what is deferred. So taxes for all seniors that are low income that fit into this program are paid by the state of Oregon through what's called a revolving account. It's just an account that was initially seeded by the state legislature, by you, and then eventually became self-funding back in the 90s. So seniors that meet certain criteria on the age of 62, certain level of income on their FAGI, federal adjusted gross income, and live and own in their own home can participate. Then eventually when they die or when they sell the home or when they refinance the home, then the money is recouped, paid back to the state, and the fund is the account is paid off. The interest accrues on these accounts at 6% simple interest, and the participation today is at right about 10,800. What has happened in the last few years is that the account, the revolving account that pays the taxes on these properties is in the red.
For you to review
so
later.
We just want to give you a little background about how that happened for some of you that have not been exposed to the interim committees from last fall. So what has happened, basically last November, the taxes that were due were $20.7 million. The available funds in the account were $13.5 million. So we had a shortfall of $7.2 million last November, and we had a conundrum. We didn't know what to do. We were going to try to borrow money, but there wasn't sufficient money available to borrow, and the conditions weren't right. So we basically paid two-thirds of the property taxes for seniors. Excuse me. And one-third we're planning to pay in May. So that's this current year. The following year, November 2011, there will only be about $7 million in the account, and our bill we expect to be about $23 million, so we'll be about $16 million short. And I will give you all this information in writing that might be passed around.
It's now, I think.
So your question might be, and we've talked about this in the fall, is why are we in this situation? How did we get so short? And how did we get so short so quick? Excuse me. Essentially, we think there's a couple of reasons for the problem, one of which is just the housing downturn. People are not refinancing their homes. People are not selling their homes. People are hunkered down. And you know, you've read in the national and the Oregon statistics for what's happening in the housing market. There is a direct correlation we've determined between how the housing market is doing and whether or not we're getting repayments to the senior deferral fund. There was also some sweeping that occurred in the revolving account. There was a significant amount of money taken out of the account for other purposes on several different occasions prior to this. From 1996 to 2005, approximately $78 million was taken out of the account for general fund operations. And in the area between 2006 and 2008, there was $14.5 million taken out of the account for purposes of transfer to the Oregon Project Independence. Now, that the sweeping or those transfers that occurred just prior to an economic downturn is what really created this problem that we're in today. And when not only were housing transactions not occurring, creating lack of repayment, it was also a time where people were short of money and actually wanting to get into the program. So our program participation shot up 25% in 2 years. We went from 8,000 participants to 10,800 participants in 2 years. And for every participant, there's an average tax of about $2,000. And then that's multiplied year over year over year. So it was kind of the perfect storm. situation. Taxes continue to rise in the average of about 3%, and all of those combined worked out to that. So we foresaw this coming back in late 2008, reported it to you in 2009, and we've been meeting with you ever since on a regular basis, keeping you updated. So we would encourage some swift action, because for next fall we won't have the money to pay for the people that are in the program. You have two handouts in front of you. The first is, I'm sorry for all the detail, but it's a very, there's a lot to this program. But the first is 10 pages, and the second is 2 pages. The 10-page one I'd like to start with first, and we'll go into as much detail as you'd like. But this is essentially the document that the work group met and talked about on January 4th. And on the work group were, as Chair Berger mentioned, she was on the work group, as was Senator Telfer, and senior advocates from a variety of entities. The first thing we talked about was, how do we solve the 2011 problem? 2011, we're expecting $16 million shortfall. What can we do? Of course, one solution would be to simply appropriate the money from the states, from Ways and Means. That's an option. Another would be to possibly sell bonds and revenue bonds or something, and pay for that over the long term. The Department of Revenue, we don't know much about how that happens. I've talked to Treasury a little bit. They talk in terms of securities, things like that. What would secure it? Would you secure it on possibility of foreclosing on seniors' homes? You know, those are kinds of things that people don't like to talk about. But that's an option for anyone who knows enough about bonding to pursue that. So I don't know if those two are options. One option would be just to pay all the taxes from the money that we have, which, again, we project to be, unfortunately, in November we project to have only $7.2 million. So if we paid the taxes for as much as we could afford, starting with the lowest payment and moving to until we run out of money, we expect that could be about in the $2,000 range. Like I said, we have 10,800 applicants currently. If you look on pages 4 and 5, you can see what we've done on page 4 on the two charts to show you for 2011 and 2012 how far we would be able to pay of the actual number of participants in the program. And you can see that the blue is the amount we would pay, and the red is those for whom we would not have the money to pay for under this, if you chose this scenario. So that gets us to between the $1,600 and $2,000 tax range. Well, the reason we only have $7.2 million in November is because we still have a May payment to make. So the money we're accruing every month from repayments right now, which is somewhere between $1.1 and $1.2 million a month that comes into the account, will be at zero in May, and then it will start accruing until November 15th, at which point we'll make this payment. So if we're at zero in November of 2011, okay, we will start accruing again about, we're projecting $1.2 million a month, and we'll have quite a bit more in the account for the 2012 payment. And so when you look at the 2012 graph, the amount we'll be able to pay is more in the $2,700 to $2,800 a month, tax amount, which will include significantly more properties. Now, that's assuming that you make no other changes to the program. If you decide to make other changes to...
Oh, Representative Moynihan.
Sorry.
Yeah. Thank you. So I just want to be clear about how we got where we're at right now. If we had followed the program the way it was originally set up and not swept these funds for other purposes, would we be having this discussion right now?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Wand, I don't think we would be in this problem.
And follow up, please. Now, I, in my other life, I do an occasional bit of probate work, and right now we're seeing more heirs than ever before simply taking the family home from the deceased as an in-kind transfer. They're not selling these homes. Is there a portion of this program that requires the heirs or the probate to sell the house?
Madam Chair, Representative Wan, there's a provision in the law that allows a delay in a small delay in the repayment for heirs, I believe, and I might want to check with program staff on that. 5 years.
You can come forward and identify yourself, and if you would.
I'm Bram Ekstrand, Department of Revenue, Program Manager for the Deferral Program. There is a provision in law that allows for an heir to occupy a property for 5 years before going into repayment.
And then one last question, if I may. Thank you,
sure.
Madam Chair. I've run into this a little bit at the city level, where one fund will loan money to another fund for different purposes. And there's always a requirement in the statute when we do that, especially from systems development charge funds, that we document the loan and that a market interest rate is paid to replenish the systems development charge fund that we've borrowed from. Is there a similar document or provision in this situation where we swept these funds?
That's an answer. That's not something that those of us who've been around a while can answer, and the answer is no. The Ways and Means Committee simply took the money, put it in the general fund, and spent it. Against my objections and many other people's objections.
Representative, these are the
great.
These are the controversial things called sweeps.
Yeah.
And I would also tell you that there was a policy decision made that OPI was a program, Oregon Project of Dependence, that needed to be supported, and this was seen as a fund to do that. Not anyone, of course, anticipating what was going to happen, but then is the dangers of life, is unanticipated consequences.
Madam Chair, I had anticipated it, and I said so pretty loudly, and I was accused of being opposed to OPI for having done that, which I was not. I was opposed to the funding mechanism. It is a very cold comfort to be able to say, I told you so.
Yes.
But I did.
And I think that the committee is getting an idea of what we're facing here, And this translates to people who have counted on deferral of their property taxes at a very tender part time in their lives. So
that's right.
Further questions? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, and perhaps we'll get to this having quickly.
We haven't gone through all these documents yet.
Sure. I would like to see at some point spatial distribution, geographical distribution for the caps and the limits that we're talking about, and how that would affect properties across Oregon, if you have that kind of information.
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, we could provide that information. We do not have that with us today for the geographic distribution.
For the committee's edification, we're going through how we got there, and then we're going through the discussion of what we as a subcommittee or as a work group came through as possible solutions, and bringing you possibilities for you to weigh, and then we will go back and get more information on where you want to go. This is sort of the where we're going with this. Thanks, John.
Okay, so on page 5, there's a bar chart that basically is just a different way of looking at who would be paid and who would not be paid under this cap. Possibility for a short-term solution, and on out years it gets better and better, down to 18% unpaid in 2012. And again, this is assuming no other changes are made. So if other changes are made to the program, that picture could look better and better.
Yes. Inquire this. You're taking into account the demographic shifts that. Well, as baby boomers age into the group that qualifies, there will be more people qualified and potentially asking about getting into this program. I mean, are you account? What you're saying is this thing recovers itself if we have enough time to do it. and I'm inquiring is to find out whether that really is true or not, or whether the short-term problem today may actually be a longer short-term problem as we go work through the baby boom bubble.
I think I can answer in a way. One of the this came up certainly in the work group, and one of the questions that's first on our options is stop digging and don't let anybody new into the program. And because absolutely this is what our policy decision makes are then drives how that's going to look going forward in terms of that demographic, because absolutely there are people want in this program. There's a waiting list right now, true, and the potential for more is huge. And so one of our kind of policy decisions are that we have to think about is, okay, in terms of where we cap and how we cap and who we let in and how we move forward on this thing, because you've hit on what an important question I don't think we have an answer for, but certainly it's been, in answer to your direct question, it was all over the work group's discussion. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Yeah.
And maybe one of the things that you could do, if you haven't already, is to take a look at utilization rates and plop on top of that the demographic shifts as they're taking, as we know they're going to take place. I mean, we know what size these cohorts are. They've been well documented in the census records for 60 years. So pretty easy to do that. It's just a matter then of plopping the demographic shift on top of utilization rates, and you can probably give us that information.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you for that question. And in our research section, economists have taken that under consideration and have included it in their projections. So we do recognize that. Thank you. So in terms of the cap, I just want to take this opportunity before we move on to longer-term solutions to punctuate the importance of a decision. We have people that are applying even today for the program, and they'll be applying and have to have their applications in by April 15th. And so they are expecting, people in the program expect that their taxes in November will be paid right now. People that are applying for the program will need to know what their fate would be too. So anything we can do to answer the questions would be we're available. Under long-term viability, one thing we could do is to close the program for new applicants. This was discussed in the work group as a possible solution. We anticipate about 1,400 new applicants this year at about $2,000 apiece. On page 6, we have two charts that were requested additional information. So we put these two charts together to show you on the top chart, which is labeled Attachment 3, where we are in 2010. The blue line is projected to continue relatively flat for if we make no change to new applicants. This is partly because of the fact that there are people annually that leave the program also. So there's people that leave, there's people that come on, but if we're to make any to help us meet the obligation, if we had less applicants or no applicants, this is what it would look like. That's strictly a policy decision on your part. It's something you could decide to stop new applicants and then come back and start them up in 2012 or whenever, some future year. And then the bottom chart just shows savings to the revolving account based on our projections from those numbers. Okay, new applicants. Number 2, is the current income threshold too high? The income threshold is currently $39,500 FAGI, which is federally adjusted gross income. Senator Telfer was helpful in pointing out the concerns with using FAGI, that it does not take into account certain types of income, like it does not take into account Social Security income. So you could be making an additional $900 a month. You could be getting veterans benefits. You could be getting income from investments. Say you have a $1 or $2 million in an account bearing interest that you're living off of, none of which would be counted in this $39,500. So The question here is do you want to take a look at what that amount should be, and do you want to look at what the means test should be on? So disposable income, household income. Currently, the law says that we will apply a household income test for the first year for the applicant. So it would be something that we've been doing. If we continued the household income test throughout the applicant's tenure in the program, we could just continue that. So household income is an option. We looked around at other states in the region, and the other states are using more a disposable and household income concept than a FAGI concept.
On this point, does the office that administers this program have access to income tax returns?
Madam Chair, Chair Barnhart, yes, we do. We have access to income tax returns, and that's the one nice thing about using FAGI was that we could check that. The downside was that a lot of seniors, only about 80% of the seniors in the program, didn't file returns.
Okay, but the ones, let me follow up. Yes. The ones with significant income outside of the measuring income probably do file returns, don't they?
Mr. Chair, that's not what Senator Telfer was understanding her to say.
All right.
That there's certain kinds of income that are not required to be, not force you to file, and I'm not an income tax expert, but
we don't tax Social Security, so that leaves that group out. I'm sorry.
But let me understand too, if you don't mind, if we could pursue this just a minute, because we had a discussion and Senator Telfer was on the phone. I didn't get all this either. You do, though, when they enter the program, look at their entire, you don't just look at a line in their taxes. You look at their entire portfolio once, but it is not reviewed thereafter.
I'm sure, yes.
So we have an initial document that says this is their income.
Madam Chair, yes, that's what the law provides currently. So we look at household income the first year, which includes all the income of the household, all the disposable income, including other people in the home.
Yep.
And then in subsequent years, the law says we look to FAGI of the individual. So there could be federally adjusted gross income from other people in the household that we cannot take into consideration. And that's the way it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the work group discussed, you know, we looked at other, what the federal poverty limit was, roughly 11,000. We looked at the median income for Oregon to be about 50,000. And there was a discussion about, well, what would the threshold be? What is a reasonable threshold, considering the program was initially conceived as a low-income senior program? What do you feel comfortable with as low income? We have, anecdotally, we have people that are processing these returns for seniors that work full-time that don't make $39,500 a year. So it's what do you think? You know, we have state workers that are working, processing these returns that are considered low income under this. So it's hard for them to... Anyway, context. So that's a question. What should the threshold be, and on what basis should it be tested? So household income, $30,000 was thrown around in the committee, but it's up to you if you think that's an issue. Page 7. Let's see. I have something on page 7. Oh, page 7 shows that an index was added back in the 2 or 03 session, right around that time, and then the amount has been indexed up from the $32,000 at that point. So it's a question, do you want to continue the indexing for now? Do you want to freeze the indexing? That's another issue. On page 1, the third, number 3 is, what's the risk to the state lien? So we pay the taxes of the senior. We place a lien on the home. What's the risk to that lien? This was discussed at length in one of the interim committee meetings. And based on that, the work group discussed two possible ways to address that. One, first of all, it's not a tax lien. It's because it's like a loan, so it's not a tax lien. Taxes have been paid. So two things we could do in keeping, the thought was that in keeping with the program is to keep seniors, low-income seniors in their home would be to have like a residency test to say the program isn't designed to help people afford to get into a new home. We've had people who get into a new home, they can only afford to get in because they don't have to pay their monthly property taxes. So one way would be to say, well, maybe there should be like a waiting period, 5 years in your new home before you can apply, and have that only occur in the year of application. Another would be to say that you should have at least maybe 20% or some percentage of equity in your home when you come in, so you're not getting a loan where it pays 100%. So that there's some equity that sort of says that right off the bat you've got something that will go to help pay off your lien when you sell it or when you die. So those are two considerations. And again, these would only be, for administration purposes, it works best to have those right at the year of application, and then if we don't have to check that every year, it would provide additional security for the loan without adding a lot of costs to the program. On page 2, we go to number 4, which asks the question of whether there should be a cap on the asset value of the home. Currently, the program has 1,390 accounts, about 13% with a market value in excess of $300,000. 215 of those are in excess of $500,000. And if you look at page 8, because the program does, there's no statutory requirement or program requirement that says anything about the value of the home. Mm-hmm. So on page 8, you see these are the top 25 accounts we have in terms of market value and the taxes associated with that. So the question is this who you'd like to target? Do you want to set any kind of limitations on market value or taxes paid?
And John didn't mention it yet, so I will, that we also had a discussion about the fact that there's differences between counties on this.
Well, part of that, of course, has to do with the value of real property.
Exactly.
In different places.
In different places.
The same house in Burns probably sells for less money than in the central part of Portland.
And in terms of that, I mean, these are kind of standouts that he's the top 25 that just make you gulp. We are paying taxes on a house of this value. But the fact of the matter is that down below, when you get down in the weeds of this thing, there are high-value Portland homes owned by poor people, but homes in Portland have this higher value. It may be the same home in Jackson County as it is in Portland, but its value is so much higher and its taxes are so much higher. So you can't just go on how much the home costs or how much the home is valued at, because there's such a variation. You may be a cabin overlooking the beach may have one value, and the same basic cabin in Portland has a completely different tax value.
I wonder, Madam yes. Chair, if and I think we have these numbers. What if we have the statistics on things like average or median home values by county? If that might be a way of making some adjustments on this kind of thing. And then the other issue question I have is whether it, as was suggested earlier, whether it doesn't make sense to include total household income when you consider whether people are eligible at all. My suspicion, and I don't know this, but my suspicion is that most of these very expensive homes listed in this chart are owned by people who were only actually considering a portion of their income in their eligibility. I'm making that up, but that would be my suspicion.
Absolutely, and I think that's the case.
Of course, if this is supposed to be a low-income benefit, and the object is to allow people who who own a home and are getting older, want to stay in their homes, and whose incomes have gone down to stay there, then it should be a low-income thing. We ought to consider all household income. The five-year limitation makes absolutely good sense for exactly the same reason. It's intended to help people stay in their homes, not help them buy a new one. I mean, several of these things sort of dovetail, it seems to me.
It is. But remember, committee members, we have a short-term and a long-term. Go ahead. Yeah.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, we have. These are all long-term things that we need to look at, this whole programmatic thing, and then we've got a short-term problem that we've got to deal with between now and April. So I think we're going to have some suggestions for how to proceed. Yes, question.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. This goes back to my question, my request earlier, to get a geographic distribution that would have the information that Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger requested. Be interesting to see, even if you have the ability to do some sort of map or something, to see for these options the geographic distribution of how it would play out. And I'm curious to understand, and the table that you have on the back of the two-pager where you talk about the percent of accounts paid imposing a tax payment cap, you have numbers ranging from 7,000 to 2,000, and my understanding is that's sort of a deeper detail of the third option around capping payments at 7,000 per account. Is it your intention, when you say a cap a payment at 7,000 per account or 2,000 per account, is it that every account would receive up to that amount of payment regardless of their actual payments, or is it that only accounts valued at that amount and under would continue to be active for this program?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, the discussion in the work group was about, as I recall it, just capping and paying no one's taxes above that tax amount as a way of capturing less needy people. The discussion was...
I'm not sure that...
If I can clarify. If you mean paying $7,000 on... at least $7,000 on every account, then we would be paying $7,000 on the account that has taxes of $24,000.
That's my question.
So what the discussion in the work group, as I recall it, was, is no, we would... the idea would be to pay no more than $7,000. Let me put it another way. Pay no one's taxes that have taxes
that's
totaling more than $7,000. No partial payments.
And you've jumped from the long term to the short term when you went from one page to the next, Representative, because we're talking generally now about the whole programmatic thing and some issues to change it, and page two is possible solutions to get us to bridge us to, so you understand the leap you just made to because economists just jump to the next chart.
Madam Chair, if I might follow up on the question, I guess I see the two issues as being related.
They are.
And as we look at the long term, I wonder if we might shift our thinking in response to the discussion about disparities between market value across jurisdictions within Oregon, to think about how we might, one potential option might be to make a flat payment that would then essentially be normalized by the value of the house, right? So you get your first X amount covered of your property tax liability, and then that would also have some equity implications, obviously, but would then essentially, as we're thinking about long-term restructuring for the program, ensure some geographic equity across the state. So just to throw that into the mix.
Yes, and absolutely. You're thinking way deep into the possibilities. And yes, Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One last comment, which is I have a lot more interest in a policy like this in making sure that Grandma and Grandpa, who have lived in a house for 45 years and can see the hole in the wall that happened in a particular incident, I'm more interested in preserving their opportunity to stay in their home as long as they are physically able to do so, regardless of the value of that home, than I am in making sure that we cover a whole bunch of people with lower value homes that maybe have only been there 6 months. because I think what we're trying to address here is an injustice that's inherent in property taxes, which is that as you get older and your income goes down, you're still paying the same amount based on value. So considering that we're trying to lessen that potential for injustice, I'm a little leery of setting caps or saying that people with larger houses or bigger farms or whatever don't get to stay in that home they've been in for 45 years.
Representative Gelzer, welcome to the discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would agree with that overall goal of making sure that people are able to stay in their own homes as long as they're able. But I do think that there is a balance that is not so much related to size but related to asset and income. And this is intended to be supporting low-income individuals that may not have other options. And I know that these are the outliers, but it's really hard to look at a home with a value of $2.3 million and not think that there is some way for that household to remain independent in a home that they own. So I think there's a balance there, and I do think that it is important to look at some caps to make sure that we are looking at those lower-income seniors who may, in fact, end up in foster care or nursing homes because they can't afford to go anyplace else. So I would tilt more towards covering that broader base of lower-income seniors.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Okay, we talked a little bit about the tax cap. Number 6 on page 2 of the larger handout is discussing the interest rate. The interest rate is currently at 6% simple interest. There's a lot of information about that. The work group discussed maybe 8% interest being a possibility, and so we'll talk a little bit about that later, but...
Number 6 on page 2.
I think there's a chart on page 10 that shows some different kinds of interest calculations that we did in preparation for the work group. A typical senior deferral account on page 10 of the handout shows that after 20 years they would owe $12,580 worth of interest after 20 years. At 6% simple, and then if you choose some other kinds of rates like 8% simple or 6% compound or the income tax rate, just some different amounts, I don't know if that's helpful for you in saying, oh, well, that's the amount I want. But just something to consider in terms of, what kind of interest rate you think is appropriate. The senior doesn't end up paying this typically because the senior, after 20 years, is probably passing on or moving on to another home or something like that, but somebody will eventually pay it. And that all, of course, that's a very long-term option because if you change the interest rate, it's not going to have effect 4 or 5 or 10 years at the earliest and then very, very incremental. So, unless there's questions on that, number 7... deals with the question of, is 62 the appropriate age to start this program? As we talked about, Representative Chair Barnhart talked about the demographic changing. People are, baby boomers are sometimes working longer now, more of them. And so is 62 the appropriate age, the Social Security age? I understand. I'm just starting to try to think about pay attention to that at my age. And so I'm not sure exactly where that's at, but there are people that are, talking about it moving out, further. So is this some states around us have 65, some states have 60, so there's a range between 60 and 65 currently out there. Do you want to move it at all? That's a question. There's a couple of pages here, actually just one page, page 3 on program fine-tuning. Not so much going to get you a lot of additional money in the revolving account for the seniors, but things that you could do, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but it would be helpful to think about them when we do get to a bill. There's a question about eliminating the proration. Currently what we have is we've got the $39,500 limit, but if you make more than $39,500, you can still get a portion of your taxes paid, and it's prorated on 50 cents for every dollar over that income threshold. So 50 cents on the dollar for every dollar you make over $30,500. So it's prorated. And they're really, if you look at the chart that's on the middle of page 3, very few people are participating. This would change dramatically, of course, if we went to a household income situation. But essentially, you've got we're doing a lot more work on a small number of accounts because we prorate, because then we have to send the county, well, we're only paying this much, and then the county says, oh, okay. Then they have to keep track of taxes owed, and then the senior has to remember, oh, I need to pay part of my taxes. And so it adds layers of complication. I'm not sure not many people are participating. It might be something you want to consider to streamline a little bit on the efficiency side. The final one would be to clarify that the state pays only up to available funds. This past year, we had November 15th, we had to make a decision. We didn't have enough money to pay all the taxes. And the law says that when we get notice of the taxes, we will pay the taxes. And so we thought very long and hard about that, and we decided that we would pay the taxes. We just wouldn't pay them all at once. And there were some people that said, well, you have to pay them, and you have to pay them all on November 15th. And so it might be a consideration for you to think about that if the account is ever in a situation like that, you want to clarify that we're not to spend more money than we have. I mean, we don't have any more money in that account. So it would help us from a legal standpoint not to have to go to court to defend the fact that we can't spend more than we have in that account. That's a fine point, but it's, legal points can be raised, and we can go to court and spend your money on that, and it might be something you want to clarify when we get to a bill. That's all I have on sort of the context and issues before we move on to the solution.
Yeah, to understand the difference between short and long term, if there was a source of money that you could get at a reasonable interest rate, how long would it take for this program to dig itself out of the hole back to even? I mean, is it 10 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 20 years?
Chairman, it would be, estimates are 5 to 10 years, it looks like, for a turnaround on this. Program participation is projected to continue to increase slightly, level off, but due to the 3% increase, our obligation on these taxes that we pay to the counties will continue to grow, and unless the economy improves dramatically in the short term, we don't see a lot of people leaving the program.
Answer the question. Yes.
It would be helpful to me. One of the things that happens is you end up with a person that lives in a house for 30 or 40 years outside the urban growth boundary, and then one day the urban growth boundary includes them, and their 30-acre farm that was worth $250,000 or less for 40 years suddenly is worth $5.8 million. And then when we're sitting in a committee hearing like this, we see a real market value of $5.8 million on the page, and we think that they're living in a Lake Oswego mansion, when it's a 1,500-square-foot farmhouse out in the outskirts of Clackamas County. So I give you a long explanation to ask you, it would be helpful for me to see the tax-assessed value as an additional column anytime we're looking at something like attachment number 5, where we show the real market value. Because the tax-assessed value will not increase quite so quickly when you have something really strange happening, like a family farm being included in the urban growth boundary. I think that will help provide us with some of the context that Representative Bailey was talking about.
Thank you.
Well, to set the stage, the work group got together and said, okay, if we have an immediate problem, what are some immediate things that we could look at that might get us through until we can have a better time to rework the entire program and make some of these longer-term policy decisions around this. And so the next handout basically is sort of the work groups sort of darts at a dartboard ideas to come back with some ideas on.
Go ahead. Madam Chair, thank you. That's exactly right. And every time we talked about a possible solution, a cap or a lowering age or income, we thought, well, what would that get us? And so that work that we did between the work group and now is to put together this sheet, excuse me, which is our best effort to, with the data that we had available, to put some numbers on some of this. So the very top, I've got current law for 2011 and 2012 with projected balance in the revolving account, and that's as of November 15th. And then the projected tax payment and the shortfall. And then below that, just some combination of options to say, oh, okay, so what if? What if we do nothing? That's the $16 million deficit and the $10.8 million deficit. What if we assume some combinations? So maybe we could move on to the combinations and talk about sort of what some of those discussions led to. So for 2000... For number one, excuse me, no new applications. Now we're in the box. The savings, $2.8 million, the simple calculation of how many people we expect to apply this next year and how much the average tax payment would be. We don't know who those people are, what types of homes they live in, or how much their taxes will be, but we're estimating it'd be about $2.8 million. If we cap the tax, excuse me, if we cap the payments to available funds, we talked about this already, we would probably pay accounts anywhere all the way from zero to up to about $2,000 of taxes, or about 54% of the accounts would be fully paid. If we cap the payments themselves at $7,000 and paid on no account that had taxes in excess of $7,000, we'd save about $500,000 next November. If we change the means test to household income, frankly, we don't know, because we haven't been asking for that income information. We don't know how people are situated, so we would have to let that play out. Lower the income test to 30,000. Again, this is something we don't know what their income levels are, how many people are bumping up against the 39.5, and if we change it to household income again, that would play into that question. So that's kind of a little bit of an unknown. The real market value cap on new applications, if we set that in the work group discussed, 300,000 and 500,000. There's also additional information on the back page that gives you a range of options from 200,000 up to a million. So you could set that, if you decide to set a cap, you could set it anywhere in that range, and that at least give you a sense of what kind of savings there'd be. So, again, about close to $1 million of savings at a $300,000 cap on market value. And $4.9 million if you set that on all existing accounts. If you set a residency equity test, you know, we wouldn't know. This is not, this is something that would be recaptured on the far end of the someone's tenure in the program, so we won't know what's available there. It's more of a security lien issue. If you set the income threshold the age threshold up to 65, we took a look at the demographics and found the range of people in that 62 to 65 range and save about $500,000 on that. Changing interest rates, again, not sure what that would be, but it would be long term. There was discussion in the work group about saying, well, if somebody completes a reverse mortgage, would they be kicked out of the program? No. Is this something we want somebody with a reverse mortgage in the program? No. So it was suggested by the work group to have this on the table as a discussion for your consideration, maybe to inactivate someone's account if they get a reverse mortgage. And finally, number 12, to eliminate the proration for excess accounts where they have excess income. And this is more of a administrative efficiency kind of an idea, and just something for your consideration. So back up to the top, we did combine a couple of the known savings scenarios. So assuming we took no new applications and we capped the tax payment at $7,000, there's some scenarios there for 2011 and 2012 of how much deficit would be with that. And then if we also capped no new applications and had a real market value cap, again, a scenario what that might get you. The only real solution we have on the table that we know of that we could implement is for 2011, which will get you to zero, would be the appropriation from the general fund or some source, or capping the tax payment at the amount of money we have. So we're ready to try to help you in any way get to a solution.
Representative Barker.
How much money would be required to make no changes in the program and simply pay it? What would we need to either appropriate or borrow from some other fund for the biennium in order to do that?
Mr. Chair, for 2011, November 15th, we think that would be $16 million. That's our projection.
Now, that's 2011. How
yes.
about the biennium?
Oh, I'm sorry. For the biennium?
Because 12 is in the biennium, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And we thought the 10,000 assumes. Okay. Yes. That would be the total of the 2011 and 2012.
27,
yes. If you see the asterisks, for 2012, we have a little assumption built in there that says assume the debt is not carried forward. So if we carry forward the debt, then, in other words, if you paid the $16 million next November, then you wouldn't be carrying forward the debt, and that would only leave $10.8 million deficit for the 2012 year. Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
Back up and let's go through it again, if you would. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So for 2011, you see the taxes that will be due is 23.2, and the 7.2 million is what we think we'll have with a deficit of 16 million. If we just simply started and only paid what we had, let's say, and not carried forward a deficit. From November 15th of 2011 and started accruing money in the revolving account from that point, we think we would have carried to the next column $14.4 million available for 2012.
Okay, if I may.
Yes.
You during the biennium, you expect to spend $48.4 million. Have I got that right? I've added the two numbers across under projected tax payment.
That's correct.
And you expect to have available to spend... wait a minute. The projected balance in the account is not the same as the amount available to spend, is it?
It's not precisely that because of the administrative costs, but...
Okay, so it is the amount available to spend. All right. So you have available to spend $21.6 million.
Roughly.
Okay, So $27 million is the right number. The dollars you have to have, if we don't make any changes to the program, that's the number of dollars you have to have that you're not going to have come in through the program in order to make these two payments on time.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Thank you.
So, as you can see, the work group left it there. There's things we didn't think of. I think that what we're looking for is what further information would guide your decision making. I think we've vetted. We have a short-term problem and a long-term problem. Certainly the long-term problem, there are some solutions, but short-term, do we want to go to Ways and Means? Do we want to talk further to the Treasurer to hold Harlem? I mean, or do we want to make some of these changes knowing that, you know, and what more do we want to know about who's going to fall out of this lifeboat, because basically that's what we're talking about here.
Well, may I? I would like to look at several things. The first set of things is reform the program so that it really does what it was intended to do, and that is to help low-income people stay in homes that they've been in for a while. That seems to me to be the first thing. I suspect that Representative Wand and I may disagree about the next piece, and I would believe that if we're talking about very high value homes, that we ought to really consider whether we're going to pay all the taxes on a very high valued home especially under the circumstances that we're in, absent some really significant issue that in terms of equity. I mean, I understand the equity point you're making, but boy, I think that makes this program really hard to defend when we're looking at a home worth, you know, millions of dollars, and we're thinking about it as a low-income protection. But that aside, I mean, assuming I lose that argument, making the other changes still makes sense to me, measuring household income, total household income, the dollars that are available to help pay taxes and along with other expenses, and the fact that we're not subsidizing the purchase of a new home when the object wasn't to do that. It was the object was to help people stay in homes that they've gotten used to. I mean, we all know, at least I certainly know, that older folks are likely to live longer and be healthier to the extent they can stay in surroundings that they are familiar with for many years. And that's a value to society. And then on the other side of it, I would really like to look at other ways of financing this thing. A couple of reasons for that. The first reason is that this is a short-term, the existing shortfall is a short-term problem, completely the responsibility of the legislature. Nobody should pretend that it's anything except the responsibility of the legislature, not this one, but the one before, last one, and the ones from late 90s through 2005. And I think the legislature has a responsibility to manage that issue, given that our predecessors, including some of us at this table, are responsible for the fact that we're in this box in the first place. I think the way you do that is you either refund it, which would be an appropriation to do that, which I acknowledge is very difficult to do this year. I mean, every time you think about refunding anything, you're taking money out of the school system and you're taking money out of health care, out of other things that we really need to do. The other possibility, since the thing does refund itself eventually, is to borrow the money somehow to cover it in the meantime. If this program really does recover in 10 years, then refinancing the thing in a way that requires a repayment seems to me that it would become solvent. It would have cash in the bank again in 20 years. I mean, obviously not in 10 years because you're making repayments, but in 20 years. I would like a real serious look at the possibilities of doing that, and that means bringing in the Treasury, and it means actually evaluating the cash flow so that a loan could be repaid over time. I, frankly, am really loath to make the kind of changes to this program that would be required to make it pay on an as-you-go basis, especially when the problem is a direct result of what the previous legislatures did. If we had left the money in the account, we would not be in this box.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to be a broken record on this, but I would say that the principle as we go forward in my mind is that I want to make sure that we are protecting seniors who live in areas that have seen some of the largest increases in the cost of housing. And I'm speaking now as somebody who represents a neighborhood in a section of Portland that is probably near the top, along with Bend and Ashland and some of these other places that have seen extreme changes in the values of a home. And it's not just for seniors that have been there for 30 or 40 years, but even seniors that bought their home in as recently as the late 1980s that have seen property values change as much as tenfold in that time. Now, obviously, because of unique nature of our property tax system, that doesn't necessarily translate into the same kinds of changes with the property tax, but still making sure that those properties in those areas are protected, because those are often some of the seniors that need the most help.
I'm going to echo what Representative Barnhart said on this. And he's a little bit mistaken in the area where we might disagree. In my mind, I am just more concerned with people that purchased a modest home when they were young, and then all of a sudden it looks to us in Salem like it's some sort of a veritable mansion because of the value. And that's the concern that I have. So we're not going to have much disagreement about the low income standard or things of that nature, but boy, I really want to take a long look at making sure that you don't have this creep where it looks like somebody is this wealthy individual when it turns out that they've just been there so long that the world all around them changed, and we got a misimpression in Salem.
Further discussion? I think we need a little bit of an action plan here. I certainly would be willing to go with my co-chair to talk to the treasurer and the Ways and Means folks about the immediate crisis before us and possible solutions. In the meantime, I think that there is a clear need for folks to sit down and rewrite, if you will, this program. We'll get into that discussion, I think, I was asked to serve on the first sort of work group to kind of scope the problem. We'll be looking for others who want to find long-term solutions, if that's amenable to the committee. Okay? Anything else on this? I have to put on the record, yesterday when the press mentioned this to me, I said, we've all gone before the public and said some really awful choices are before this legislature. Welcome to the table, members. Here they are, right in front of us, and there are no good answers here. And things that are really important to people are on the table. So I need to open, before you have a bill, what's the number?
2543.
Yes. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2543. This is the vehicle, members. Christine, you can tell us what it says, if you would.
House Bill 2543 is the placeholder for the senior property tax deferral program changes that might be made. But right now, it changes the simple interest rate from 6% to 8% on the accounts as they build over time.
Thank you. This is the vehicle that has been presented to us for possible sort of immediate changes that might want to be made. That we can amend at our discretion. So we've now presented it, and we will be talking to all of you about possible solutions. And while we have it open, we have a testifier. Rick Bennett, would you like to come forward and talk about this? I think it's appropriate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. And I'll keep my comments brief and, for the most part, echo much of your discussion this morning as well. I was a member of the work group who met, and I really appreciated that conversation. I think, by and large, clearly the intent was to try and find not only short-term but long-term solutions that will ensure that this program is sustainable over the long term. And at AARP, we talk about aging in place, and several of you have referenced that in one way or another. And indeed, as Co-Chair Barnhart mentioned, allowing the individual to stay in their home, stay in their neighborhood, their community, and so forth, not only benefits the individual, but it benefits the community as well. And, you know, we had a good discussion on a number of these options in the work group. We asked Mr. Phillips to come back with more numbers and so forth. He's done that. But, of course, obviously, just having received this today, I'm certainly in no position to make suggest one option or another or some combination of options and so forth. But I would hope that you would keep that work group or establish a new work group to work with you in considering these various options and so forth. Also, I would mention that it's my understanding when this program was initially created that indeed it was done so on a loan from the state, and indeed over a number of years that loan was paid back, and I believe over time funds have been taken from that surplus for various purposes. And indeed, I think it was 05 where there's a legislation passed that allowed some funds to be used from the surplus to support OPI. I'm very certain that the legislative record shows that the intent of that was to use some of those funds to supplement general fund dollars. It was never the intent of the advocates in any case that this fund or this program and its surplus would be the sole support for Oregon Project Independence. And indeed, that is certainly one of the factors that has led to the deficit we're currently facing. So I certainly hope that we can find a path that allows us to sustain this program. It certainly, like I say, it is a benefit both to the individuals who certainly over time have seen the value of their homes increase dramatically and now living on more limited funds have difficulty paying the taxes. Thank you.
Questions for Rick? Thank you. Anyone else like to come forward? Jordan?
For the record, Jody Weiser. I, too, served on that committee. And I think there were two things that have come up today that were addressed in the committee that I didn't hear it echoed. One was Telfer's comment that you can have zero AGI and a net worth of $5 million. And I think one of the things we could look at is looking at not just looking at income. I've had years where my income, my AGI, would have qualified me. That does not represent my ability to pay those taxes. It just happens to be that I didn't sell many stock that year that had any gains, so I didn't have any income to show. And secondly, I happen to be in a property very much like what you described, Representative Wand. And I do have options outside this program were I low income. I could subdivide my property and add four houses and create a little community around myself. Or I could, on the public market, go and get a loan against the value of that property and use that loan money to pay off my property taxes. And I think that if you don't expect people to use those other mechanisms in the market, part of what you're doing is giving them more latitude than maybe they need. That there are usually options if your house has gone up in value a lot and it's paid off. And it would be paid off because there would be a lot of equity available to borrow. That those aren't the nicest loans out there, but they're a choice that people with high assets actually end up having. Thank you.
Thank you. Question? Thank you. Okay, do we have any other comments or further information that you think you'd like to grab or other things that you would want? You can come to us later if it doesn't occur to you now. We will. To be continued is an understatement here.
Okay. we have to do something, don't we?
Yeah. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2543. We've done our work session. I don't think there's anything else on our agenda today. So with that, we are adjourned.
Good.
Thank you.